why don't we dig in? And hope you all got a handout on the way in. Last time we were together, we were in 1 Samuel 7, and we saw that 20 years had elapsed from the time that the Israelites had received the Ark of the Covenant back from the Philistines. And in that time, about half a generation, there had been a movement back towards God. And we said that people were getting hungry now once again, but not for the Ark per se. They were starting finally to get hungry again for God himself. And under the leading of the Spirit, Samuel senses that the time is right to gather the nation and call everybody to repentance. So he tells them that if you're returning to the Lord, then you have to put away your false gods and commit your heart only to the Lord and serve him only. And so the people gather together to fast and confess their sin to God. So the Philistines find out about this great gathering of Israelites and they move against it. But the Lord was merciful to hear their prayers and he sent some supernatural help. And we saw how God's hand was now going to be against the Philistines for all the days of Samuel's life. And the chapter closes with a picture of a land that has some measure now of peace finally, and that's recovering. So Samuel is ministering in a circuit. He's traveling around Israel, and he's judging the people. Unfortunately now, over time, the people's hearts start drifting away again. Maybe not in an open and idolatrous way, but in a subtle way. And it's also, though, even though it's subtle, they drift away in a fashion that is also going to bring heartache to the nation. So as we head into chapter 8 now, we are about to see that the people are going to get way ahead of God. Did you ever, anybody here ever get ahead of God and pay for it? The people are going to get ahead of God and they're going to ask the Lord for something which is potentially dangerous. So in verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." Well, Samuel is now grown old. How old is he? We don't know. There are different opinions. The Jewish tradition that exists today says that you were old at 60, and when you were 70, they called you gray-headed. Rita's shaking her head. Keep going. Our sister Rita's over the 90 mark. God bless her. But looking at Samuel's story, this makes sense because now another 20 years has passed, probably 20 good years of prosperity. Samuel was about 40 when he called the people to repentance. And it seems reasonable now that he's describing himself as old that another 20 years would have transpired. He's got two sons and their names are theological statements because he has very consciously tried to name his two sons in such a way that their name would glorify the God of Israel. So Joel, which is Yoel in Hebrew, means Yah is God, right? Yahweh is God is what it means. And Abijah, or really it's Abiyahu, means my father is Yah. So he says, I'm going to give these guys the most Yahweh-honoring names I can come up with, right? And he makes them judges, and probably they assisted him because it was getting too difficult for him to cover the entire country. They're based down in Beersheba at the southern extremity of Israel, and they probably helped their father judge the bottom half of the country. Now, there's some precedent for Samuel's actions. One of the old judges back in the book of Judges was a guy named Jair. We don't know anything about him really, but it says that he had 30 sons who rode on donkeys, probably to judge their towns. And that seems to have worked out okay for this guy Jair, but in Samuel's case, it did not work out very well at all. So we see corruption in his sons, just like earlier in the book, we saw it in the sons of Eli. So the passage says that they made dishonest gains, they took bribes, they perverted justice, meaning that if you came to them to settle a lawsuit, a dispute, whatever it was, they might rule in favor of whoever took care of them better. You catch my meaning, right? So, you know, Samuel is one of those rare people in the scripture whose sins or shortcomings we really hear nothing about. So in that way, he's similar to Joseph, or he's similar to the prophet Daniel later on, because you never hear anything about him sinning. But it seems that he has one significant failing, that he might not have been the best father. That may be unfair, of course, because as everyone here who is a parent knows, we shouldn't say that parents are necessarily to blame for what their children do. But the contrast of these men with Samuel is very striking. And so we have to wonder if maybe there's a lack of supervision there, a lack of correction, right? I'll be sympathetic to Samuel here, because growing up in the house of Eli certainly did not provide Samuel with good models of fathering or, you know, correcting children, right? In fact, one of the reasons, you'll remember, I think, that one of the reasons why Eli was judged in the first place was that the Holy Spirit said that he had failed to restrain or to correct his sons. So in any case, however surprising this may be to you, Samuel's sons were a mess, just like Eli's sons had been. And they made a lie and a mockery out of the names that their father had given to them. Mm-hmm. So what's the outcome of this? So in verse 4, it says, all the elders then of Israel gathered together. And they came to Samuel at Ramah, which is his hometown, you remember, and said to him, look, you're old. Thank you, guys. And your sons do not walk in your ways. Now, make us a king to judge us, like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they've done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So, excuse me. As I'm saying there, it's a foolish request, but it's a surprising answer, right, from the Lord that he's going to give them their request. We're not sure who these elders are. There is, some of you know in the scriptures, there's a group of 70 elders in Israel who actually went up on the mountain with Moses and the priest, and they saw God and ate and drank in God's presence. And that group becomes probably the Sanhedrin that you read about in the Gospels, which is a group of 70 Jewish elders. This is probably not that group. This is probably just the various representatives of the tribes of Israel and the clans that made up those tribes. But how awkward is this, right? These elders come to suggest to Samuel, in his own home no less, that it's time for him to retire. Right. So you just know, right, that any conversation that starts off with, you know, you're old now, is probably not going to be a good conversation. But they ask Samuel to make them a king to judge them. And here's the really disturbing and disappointing part. They say, like all the nations. Right. Samuel takes this personally. I want to give Samuel a lot of credit here for going and praying about it. Because this is not our response typically. When somebody says something to really burn us, you know, we usually have something to say back. You know, we usually don't just nod and go like that and walk away and go back and pray. We usually react or respond, right? And Samuel, I think Samuel, this was setting off a lot of different chains of thought in his mind, because I think Samuel suspected that it might be time for Israel to have a king. And there's reasons for that, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But God gets to the heart of the matter immediately, and he tells Samuel, look, this is really about rejecting me, rejecting the Lord, so that he should not reign over them. See, in the past, whenever the people had a great leader, whether it was Moses or Joshua or Gideon or now Samuel, everybody understood that those famous human leaders that we know, they were leading for Yahweh, right. But Yahweh was ruling, right? God was giving direction to those servant leaders of his. The guidance and the initiative for what was supposed to happen was happening from the Lord, not within the human leader. But a king, a real king, is something different. Because a king might reign and do his own will in a way that no leader of Israel had ever done. A king could become tyrannical. So there's a few different things here and some troubling dynamics. First, I wonder if the leaders were afraid that Samuel was trying to set up hereditary judgeships, right, by choosing his own son. It's interesting to me that Gideon was a leader who had rejected the idea of hereditary leadership. He was kind of like George Washington. You remember that they wanted George Washington to be king? And he said, no, are you nuts? Or something like that. Or he said, art thou nuts, I guess. But seriously, after Gideon saved Israel, the people came to him and they wanted to make him king, and he refused. What a great quote in Judges 8. It says, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" So here's an interesting question, right? We admire Samuel a lot as we've come to see him these past weeks, but was Gideon maybe wiser than Samuel? Interesting question. Or maybe because Samuel had lived through this catastrophe of the loss of the ark and seen Israel at one of its really low points, maybe Samuel was too pessimistic about the people and about their heart and what the people wanted. So maybe he thought he could keep the people from backsliding if he retained more control over things. Anyway, it's a measure of the respect, I think, that they had for him, that they came to him and asked him for a king. So that's something in their favor anyway. A second thing, though, that's more disturbing to me is that the people are overlooking the fact or forgetting the fact that in the past, God delivered them all by himself. And the men and the women that God used were only his instruments. And God has a good habit, as I think you know, of choosing the least likely and weakest and weirdest people that he could find to rescue his people. So, and also in the 20 additional years that have passed, the people's hearts are starting to turn away from the Lord again. Like I said, albeit in a subtle way, and not with idolatry, but they've committed a grave sin here because they were prideful and they wanted to be like all the other nations. They wanted to be seen and be thought of the way that other nations were viewed, the way that other nations were looked at. They wanted to be seen. Listen, guys, here's a big trap for every believer. They wanted to be perceived as normal. We want to be like everybody else. Make us a king who will judge us like the other nations. And that was a great rejection of their mission, of their calling, of the destiny that God had for them, which was that they should not be like the other nations at all. This is the thing that Moses says to them and that you see in the Psalms, right? There's this call to remind them always, what other nation is there like this that has this God for them and among them? What other nation has the actual presence of the glory of God in their midst? And here they are in response to that, and that's their calling. In response to that, they're like, no, make us a king like everybody else has. I think it was because they had started to enjoy some peace and prosperity again, that they thought they could be like the other nations. So to me, they're kind of like the modern secularists, right? Because what happened? They turned the worship of God, their worship of Yahweh, into a religion instead of seeing God as their life, right? So, well, religion's okay as long as you keep it in its place. So in a sense, they were kind of like Esau, that he was trading away his birthright, and he didn't value the things that that set him apart from other nations. The last thing here, and we'll see this later on when Samuel goes deeper into this, is that the people were starting to be afraid of their enemies. Once again, there were some new enemies that were starting to appear on the horizon. We'll talk about that down the road. We find out later that the people were letting that fear creep in, even though God had been giving them supernatural help against the Philistines. Their flesh was weak, and they were giving in to fear. So, very interesting to me here that God gives the people their request. You know that sometimes God will give the people what they want if they are insistent enough upon it. And you know that that is not a blessing. That's a judgment. You know that Pastor Glenn and I both preached about that idea when we were going through Romans the last year, right? Sometimes in judgment, God will hand you over to something. And sometimes, as seems to be the case here, human beings, and including believers sometimes, are like obnoxious airline passengers who insist that, you know, they could fly the plane better than the pilot. You know what it is now. Every month there's a new story of a passenger that freaks out, right? And, you know, sometimes God says, well, okay, let's see how you do flying the plane then. You want to fly the plane so bad? You go right ahead and fly it. I'm done resisting you. God says, my spirit will not always, what? Strive with man. There comes a point when we persist in our stubbornness and foolishness that God says, okay, I'm taking off the restraint. So now God says to them, okay, fine, listen to them. Give heed to their voice. Now, a lot of what's in Samuel here with names of people and important key points like this, it's all wordplay. What does Samuel's name mean? Do you remember all the way back? It means that the people asked of God, and he was sought after by God, by his mother, right? So his name means the one who is asked for by God, right? And now God says, okay, listen to their voice, go ahead and listen to them, but tell them what kind of king this is going to be. So in verse 10 it says, so Samuel told, or he recited, all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. Will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest. Some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys and put them to his work. By the way, we don't see it here, but a few chapters down the road, when we have this king in place, we do get the detail that these words came to pass. And the king who was given to them would literally, whenever they saw some guy that was a big guy, they would just grab him and drag him into the army. Verse 17, he will take a tenth of your sheep and, listen, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you've chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Wow. So Samuel paints a distressing picture. First, and the part that gets overlooked here, is that Samuel, in verse 10, he told them exactly what God said. You would have hoped that that was enough to make them repent. You know, if Samuel, of all people, came out and said, listen, I talked to Yahweh about this, and he says, you're rejecting him. Wouldn't that have created at least one oops, right, in the crowd? So on top of what God said to him, which we just read, and then he repeats that to the people, he takes them through this laundry list of all these confiscations that the king's going to make. And then he, you know, is elaborating on the nature of the king. He's telling them, listen, previously you only had obligations to God and you didn't have to worry about taxes and so on. How much more prosperity, and this is not a political statement, this is a thought experiment here with me, right? Do this thought experiment. How much more money and productivity would there be if there were literally no taxes in the country? No tax to the U.S., New York, Connecticut, city, whatever. See, these folks had no taxes. All they had was whatever tithing and offerings they were supposed to make to the Lord. But now he says you will have taxes, heavy taxes to your king. The king would even take your land and children. Say, you know, that's a nice field that you have there, Sal. Thank you. Wait till you see what I do with it, right? And whereas they had once been a free people, now they would not even enjoy personal liberty. You know, and here's the sad part, because of who they were, because their nation begins with the story of God rescuing them from slavery. He had taken them from slavery and made every man the lord of his own castle, so to speak. But now they were going to have a king who might just take their sheep and even their sons and daughters. And God indicates through Samuel that there would be no going back from this, which of course came to pass, and they would come to regret it, but God would not eliminate the monarchy once the people ratify their decision. And instead of having Yahweh as their king, they might be subject to the will of a mere man. And you could get a good king, or you could get a really bad king. And they had some really bad kings. Now, the sad thing was that a king was actually needed. And having a king was provided for. It was actually part of God's ultimate plan to have a king. But the people were asking God prematurely and for foolish reasons. What a lesson that is for us in our prayer lives and the things that our hearts long for, right? Sometimes inappropriately, asking for things prematurely and asking for things for foolish reasons. It was always God's plan to have a king in Israel someday, but in his timing, and to have the right kind of king. What would that king look like? Well, we find out, Moses tells us in Deuteronomy 17. It says, when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. And also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book, from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, so that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So notice the qualifications for kingship. First, he has to be an Israelite. Has to. That's why the Jewish people never accepted the Herod family, because they were not Israelites, they were Edomites. Also, he can't multiply horses, meaning he's not allowed to rely upon human strength or human war-making power. And he can't cause the people to go to Egypt. See, all of those things there speak of the world and using the world's strength and using the world's methods. Also, he can't multiply wives because they will pull his heart away. Sorry, ladies, that doesn't mean that you ladies are intrinsically bad. It means not with, you know, luxury or lust or anything else. It means by serving their gods. So many times, of course, ancient kings would marry women, right, as a way of making political alliances with the surrounding nation. So if you're the king and you marry the Pharaoh's daughter, right, then Pharaoh is your friend, or perhaps even your master. And then you have some safety in your country because the Pharaoh is not going to invade and attack the home of his own daughter or his own grandkids, which are your kids now. So just as in the case of the horses, this is a problem because it's another way that the king would be choosing worldly security, and they were not supposed to marry certain ethnic groups and be involved in the worship of their gods. Finally, he can't multiply gold and silver. Now, that obviously speaks of greed and the other problems that typically come with having money, like trusting in riches. Mm-hmm. So in all of these possible sins of Israel's king, notice that every single one of these, there's this element of the king possibly relying on the arm of the flesh, when they're only supposed to lean on the arm of the Lord. Now, did you think of anybody as I went through that list? Did it strike you that King Solomon did all three of these things in spades? He was famous for horses, right? Famous for women and for wealth. So there's some brilliant foreshadowing here in the story that one day a king was going to come along and do all these things in an over-the-top way, and that it would lead to disastrous consequences. But instead of losing his heart to these things, there were some things that a king of Israel was supposed to do. So you see there, he was supposed to write out by hand his own copy of the Torah. Isn't that amazing? You know, we've rediscovered in the last few years that now that we all type everything, they've rediscovered that writing something with your hand is, because of the neural pathways, it emblazons it on your mind better than any other method. And, you know, if you've never done it, I highly recommend to you, write out the Bible, write out books, long passages of the Bible for yourself with your own hand. It's a very powerful way to burn the Word of God into your heart. And he was supposed to keep it with him. I like that. He was supposed to be, you know, everybody's cool now, so they all have their Bible on their phone. So the king was supposed to be that last dude left that came to church with the big Bible under his arm. And he was supposed to read it every day so that he might fear God and keep the word and not get puffed up with pride. And if he did that, Moses said his days would be prolonged. What a great mini sermon. That's another free sermon I just gave you with like three different points. So that was the king that they were supposed to get. That was the king that God would have wanted them to have. But that was not the king they were going to get, as we'll see in weeks to come. So verse 19, nevertheless, and this is a very sad nevertheless, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel and said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed their voice and make them a king." And Samuel said to the men of Israel, "Every man go to his city," or to his own city. In other words, they had all gathered there at Mizpah, wherever they were, and Samuel said, "Okay, camp meeting's over. All of you go home. Meeting is over." And, you know, Samuel would have said, if it were nowadays, he would have said, "Don't call us, we'll call you," right? Well, Samuel said, "I'll let you know when I have any information for you." So this is really tragic, guys. And even after hearing Samuel reciting all this woe, including God's own words, they doubled down. They said they want to be like all the Gentiles, all the nations, even doubled down by saying, "Hey, we not only want our king to judge us, but we want our king to fight our battles." So that's an even more explicit rejection of God's leadership. Can you picture Samuel cringing at this? Didn't the people remember the Red Sea? How Moses said, "Fear not, Yahweh shall fight for you," right? Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. The Lord it is, He will who will fight for you. So here was the instructions, which obviously they forgot, that Moses gave them in the Torah about what to do when they have a future war. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. By the way, take this for yourself, because who's your priest? Anybody who's not a missionary, answer that question. Jesus, thank you. So imagine when you're faced with battle, this is what your priest is saying to you. Hear, O Israel, today you're on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint. Do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is He who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. Isn't that an awesome word? That's what they were supposed to remember. That's how their leaders were supposed to address them before battle. So what a rejection this was of their past. And what a rejection of the living God with whom they're in covenant. And they're not talking to a statue here. They're talking to God.
Right.
And His prophet is conveying to them precisely what God is saying to them on the matter. So he goes back to pray again, and God says, okay, listen to their voice and give them a king. And the chapter ends on that sad note that Samuel sends everybody home. And now we have anticipation as we're waiting to see what happens next and who is this king going to be that the people have asked for. And there's another pun in there that you're going to see, because the name of that king, of course, is Saul, and Saul's name means asked for. Samuel's name means requested from God, but Saul's name just means asked for. Wow, is right. And those guys, those are two very different things. And Saul would end up displaying, as we'll find out, after a so-so start, he would end up displaying all of those terrible characteristics that Samuel warned them of, and even worse than that. Thank God we know later on in the book, there's another young man who probably is not born yet at this time, but I don't think, even though it's not apparent in the text, I don't believe that Saul is actually surfacing in the story for about 10 years. Because the next time Samuel comes out, he says, "I'm old and gray-headed." So that could be a clue to us that Samuel is now 70. When he anoints Saul, and Saul will be a mess. As we go through the next chapters, we're going to meet Saul. We're going to find out how he was anointed, his early career as a king. You're going to see his fears. You're going to see his insecurities. You're going to see his anger, his jealousy, his irrationality. And it just keeps snowballing until he just becomes purely murderous, even to the point of having these priests, many of whom were certainly very godly people, having them murdered by the score. So it's going to be very interesting. But God will be raising up a true king, a young man who will be a man after God's own heart. So we know that's coming. So, all right, that's what I had to share. Anybody have any questions or anything to throw into the soup? Yeah, Dom.
Gave them their request, but he sent leanness to their souls.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And it's, it's interesting that here, these folks had already made up their mind. And we look at Samuel's words and we say, how come you can't see that? But I think this has been brewing in their heart probably for a long time.
Right.
And God was at the point, okay, listen to them. So they were the principal there. They were given over.
Yes.
So Samuel could say whatever he wanted, and they didn't have ears to hear anymore, heart to obey.
Yeah. And you notice a couple things there. Notice that God is always very just. God will always come out and justify, even though he doesn't have to, because he's so kind. God will justify his own ways to mankind. So he says, okay, let them have what they want, but tell them exactly how it's going to go down. Right? So that's the mercy of God. The other thing there, just playing off what you said, is that this book, 1st and 2nd Samuel, is a lot about godly leadership, right? And the one thing you see in here was that the leadership, there was no real leadership. That there was some at the top, but it wasn't distributed across the nation, right? So you had almost no leaders, apparently, that could sway the people. And when we get deeper into the book, way towards the back, you will see Samuel and David working together and raising up and ordaining elders, you know, which is a really powerful statement, right? Because evidently it's not sufficient just to have one amazing guy, Samuel. It's not sufficient to turn the heart of the nation. There have to be other people there speaking into the young people, correcting people, whatever it is. Just like we saw last time, if you were with us, we had to jump back to the book of Joshua or Judges, and saw that as long as those elders that were alive in the time of Joshua, as long as they all stayed alive, it was okay. The nation rolled forward in a good way of serving the Lord. But once all the elders of that generation died, it fell apart. And they began to serve the Baals and all these other gods. So that tells me that people, churches, Christians, Christian leaders, have to be very intentional about raising up the next generation. Yes. I mean, if it could happen to the people like Joshua's generation that saw the Red Sea split and the Jordan divided and the walls come a-tumbling down and all these things, if revival and worship of God could end when those guys died, that means they didn't transmit it down. Not that the young people didn't know the stories, but it wasn't real. It wasn't alive to them. There was no training, right? What we're told in the New Testament, to raise your children in the nurture and the admonition, meaning the warning, the admonishing of the Lord. And the failure to do that created chaos. So we've all got to, in our own sphere, whoever we're touching in our own sphere of influence, be very conscious of the need to mentor people, to sow into people. Because when we don't, you know, our faith is powerful, but it's also very fragile. If it doesn't get passed on, it ends right there. That's it. So, there's another free mini sermon there. Feel free to use that. Anybody? Yeah, Charles.
The first verse says, "Now King Samuel, when Samuel was old, had many sons to judge over Israel." He doesn't talk about him seeking the Lord before making his sons to judge over Israel.
Right.
Which is a very big decision. And as a parent, sometimes we might see flaws in our kids, but sometimes we choose not to see them. You know, so I wonder what it was with
Samuel
in that aspect. And,
yep.
And
right. Yeah. No, great point. I mean, we all have blind spots, and especially as parents, you know, we can be fooled and say, well, he'll be all right. It's just a phase he's going through. You know, Eli was 98, and he was like, oh, it's just a phase they're going through. You know, my 60-year-old sons, the priests, are ruining Israel, but it's just a phase they're going through. Right? No, I mean, seriously, God help us. This is, you know, this is life and death here. And all of those things, you know, every time you get burned like the people were, whether it was by Eli's sons or, you know, Samuel's sons, or every time somebody gets burned today by someone, a religious leader in a position of authority, right? It just increases people's frustration, increases their cynicism about the things of God or the church or whatever it is. So it's sort of like, it's important. It's important to insist on that. And it's hard. You know, it's hard as a parent. So, yeah, Donna. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure which. Hezekiah? Yeah, it could have been. Right. Right. Yep. So all that godliness, to that late age, everything was involved. Because he fell. I think pride got in his way. So it's like, and yet he grew up with all, even with the prophets, Isaiah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a difficult issue, but it's you know, there are a lot of admonitions like that in the Word, right? You know, to hold fast to the end in many different places. You know, we have to hold on more earnestly to the things that we've heard and not, you know, seem to let them slip at any time. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that nowadays we don't seem to worry about those passages as much as our forebears did. And that's a problem. You mentioned the book of Revelation, specifically overcoming. Those people were in life and death situations, which of course many people are still facing today. It's very academic for us here, isn't it? But I mean, for the people to whom those seven letters were originally written to in Revelation 2 and 3, that was life or death. And they were very liable at any point to be grabbed by somebody and threatened with even death, not just the loss of a job, but death unless they would worship the divinity of the emperor. And here's Jesus writing to those people through John and saying, no, you be faithful to me even to the point of death, and I will give you a crown of life. So it's academic for us in our country, but many people are living that out. And it was a very big argument in the early church as to whether people who had failed in that moment should ever be allowed back in the church again. Because that was an issue. When the pressure of persecution lifted, all these people wanted to come back and be followers of Jesus again. And it was a huge argument in the early church. It's like, listen, man, when the pressure was on, you denied Jesus. So that was a big debate whether people could really do that or not. So.
Majority of the kings in Israel, both the kingdoms, the majority of them were failures, you know, were bad kings. And it's interesting here that you wrote down here in Deuteronomy, even before they started having kings, God had given them the prescribed thing and what they should do.
Right.
You know, in writing out copies of the scriptures, keeping it with them and reading it every day. And I just think to myself, how much different it would have been they enacted simply what God said. Mm-hmm. How much different it would have looked. Israel would have looked. The kingdoms would have looked. And, you know, and even today for us, you know, with our families, you know, if we just enact what God says, to be in the Word every day, you know, to read the Word, that's just a great admonition. I never even really thought about actually writing down my own copy of the scriptures, you know. But it's just that slow drift. I mean, no one wakes up someday and says, I don't want to walk with the Lord anymore. You know, it's just that slow drift of not being in the Word, not being in fellowship. And then you look at people, man, where have you been?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, an old pastor that you and I used to know had a sermon called The Deceptive... Listen to this. The Deceptiveness of the Gradual. And it's very deceptive, right?
Wow.
right? The enemy's not going to come out dressed in red tails and a pitchfork and say, I am the devil, serve me, right? Because you're not going to buy that. But one little drop at a time, right? So, yeah. Right.
Sometimes we, going through life, we'll see things happening around us, and I mean, even look what happened in Las Vegas, you know. And you know, sometimes it really, you know, burns you to your core, but you can't take it personally. Yeah. You know, and just go through the Lord, just like Samuel.
Yeah.
He didn't begin.
Yeah. Which is not easy, you know. It's not easy. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we face that. You know, we face that as pastors, right? You could preach a sermon and somebody will come up to you and say how great it was, and somebody else will, you know, come and critique it. You know, I know people don't do that at harvest time, but actually, they do sometimes. Sometimes we have people leave us notes and anonymous things, and you know, so you have to realize who it is that you're working for. You know, for whose pleasure, right? Whom are you seeking to please by the... And that's obviously not for pastors only. That's for everybody. But these things come to test us. They come to rock us because by nature, we want to be loved. We want to be accepted. We especially... And this is one of the hardest tests for anybody in leadership or for any Christian. It's this test of being misunderstood, right? That's not what I meant. That's not what I intended. Why would they think that about me? Don't they know me? You know me. Why would you say that about me? Right? Very difficult. And the Lord brings us through these things to train us so that we become, you know, unoffendable. Yeah. Jesus said, because of iniquity, the love of many will grow cold. It's because we are exposed to so much iniquity, or because it's committed to us, that our hearts grow cold and we say, well, yeah, I love them, but it's cold love. You don't really love them in a real fashion anymore because of the level of offense that they've dumped onto your head, like the ice bucket challenge. You know, it shocks you, right? That's the power of offense, that, you know, living in the last days, we have to guard our hearts with that and make sure that these strongholds of offense cannot find a place. How beautiful of Jesus, right? The Last Supper. Jesus said, the prince of this world is coming and he has nothing in me. Nothing at all in the heart of Jesus that the enemy could use to his own purpose. You know, and what a thing to shoot for, you know, in the development of our own character, that we could be that unoffendable, you know, and just pray for that person.
And this unoffendability is the key to unity, because a lot of people leave churches over some doctrinal reasons or whatever, and they're really just offended.
True.
Mm-hmm. And not realizing that if we're ever going to get to the next place in God, you know, we're going to have to follow imperfect people, because there's no perfect people out there. And, you know, it's like walking in that, not allowing yourself to take offense and be offended.
Right.
It's one of the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
It is, especially in the body. And that's how the enemy works, to divide us too.
Yeah.
By that, it leads to cold love, just like you said. And
yeah.
It's important.
So powerful. Here's the thing, guys. I mean, if you really believe that we're living in the last days, would it not be possible, maybe even certain, that God himself is leading us through those things so that we have the kind of heart that we need to survive and to really display who he is to people? I mean, because God loves you that much to perfect your character in that way. So those things very often in our lives are coming from God's hand to make us more, you know, Lord, make me more like Jesus, right? It's like we want to pray those things so piously, but the way that God answers that sometimes is by having people be really nasty to you. Yeah. It's true. So can we embrace that, right? I mean, it sounds insane, and an unbeliever would never have a vocabulary to know what we're talking about, but to embrace that kind of cross in your own life of those things, of being misunderstood, of being rejected, of being, you know, because whatever. It could be because you have money, because you don't have money, because you're not the right color, because you don't have the education, whatever it is. That's the reality of life. And how do we deal with that? How do we embrace that? We bring those things to the Lord and get grace to live and to respond to them the way that He would, you know. So. Blessing blockers.
But anyway, my question is, why came all this insight? We are judged by the light we have on the people, and I don't have this knowledge and don't care to have it, will kind of be safe because they only are judged by the light they have. So why develop and learn more, in a sense, if we're going to be judged harder than and because what we know, if they're going to get away with the little they know, in a sense?
Yeah. Well, because you have, if you love the Lord, you have something in your heart that is compelling you to pursue Him.
Right.
And you know, I have found Him whom my soul desires. So is it that those people are safe, but or is it that the height of the reward they could get would be lower than somebody who's pursuing the Lord hard and failing? I mean, David failed a lot. And yet God still describes him as a man after his own heart. You get into the book of Revelation and Jesus is even not ashamed to call himself by David's name. I am the root and offspring of David. You know, so God loves those that pursue him, who read, you know, in Hosea it says, so let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. And God honors that so much, you know, when we pursue him in the knowledge of God. You know, we are, the greatest commandment is that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The greatest commandment is not that you succeed. Because he knows our frame, Psalm 103. He remembers that we are only dust. But in the real hard pursuit of him, there will be grace to do better. There will be grace, you know, more to long for his heartbeat and to capture him. To lay hold. Paul says, I am laying a hold of the thing for which I myself have been laid a hold of. And that's how we have to approach it. Good stuff. I'm glad I fought the parking lot. Sorry. Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you for coming. Don't forget, next week we're going to be in the other room on the other side there, just at the corner.